Welcome to the debate. Imagine two patients in an emergency room. Both have just been stamped with the exact same disease label, pneumonia.
Okay, classic ER scenario.
Right. So patient A is sitting up, checking their phone, breathing comfortably, just running a fever. But patient B is, you know, confused. Their blood pressure's tanking, their kidneys are shutting down, and they are struggling for every single breath.
Yeah, patient B is crashing.
Exactly. But if the disease label, pneumonia, is exactly the same for both, why is our medical system perfectly designed to treat that label, but so often, I mean, completely blind to the actual failing person sitting right in front of us?
Well, because the label is what unlocks the cure. I mean, it's a roadmap, but you're right. It's a roadmap that doesn't always show you the reality of the terrain.
Yes, the terrain is incredibly messy, and today we are looking at a text that tries to remap that terrain entirely. Dr. Bichar Sakhale's Internal Medicine Made Easy. It proposes this radical shift away from our traditional disease-centric diagnostic model.
Right, replacing it with the life-coherent model.
Yeah, a life-coherent clinical reasoning loop. And honestly, reading through this, I think it might be the only way to save internal medicine from its own sort of fragmentation. It forces us to stop asking, what disease does this person have? And start asking, how is this person's capacity to live actually failing right now? And I'll be arguing that this is a vastly superior foundation for medicine.
And I'll be arguing the exact opposite. Because as a clinician, that framing really worries me. I mean, holistic care sounds wonderful in a lecture hall, you know? But on the ground, when a patient is dying, we need that disease label. It has to remain our primary cognitive anchor.
But doesn't it leave out?
Wait, let me just finish. Without it, people die. If we start prioritizing generalized capacity failures over objective biomedical diagnoses, we are risking massive cognitive overload and, frankly, deadly delays in treatment.
Okay, let's unpack that, because I think traditional medical learning inherently fragments the patient. Think about how doctors are actually trained.
Mm-hmm.
You spend a month on cardiology, then a month on nephrology, then pulmonology. You study these independent organ systems, which is clean, you know, it's necessary for memorization, but it fails spectacularly at the bedside.
Well,
patients just don't walk in with textbook diagnoses neatly confined to one organ.
True, they present with symptoms. I mean, they come in breathless or weak or in pain.
Right, they present with syndromes. Dr. Selle's text argues that defining an illness purely by the disease label leaves out the absolute most important data. He introduces this concept of capacity failure.
The six-step loop?
Yeah. Are they failing to oxygenate, failing to circulate blood, failing to clear toxins? This accurately maps what the living organism can no longer sustain. Because, you know, breathing affects cognition. Kidney function dictates whether a medication is safe or toxic. The life-coherent loop looks at the interconnected whole.
I hear you, but biomedical reductionism, distilling that messy, interconnected presentation down to a single specific disease, that is actually a safety feature. It's not a bug.
How is fragmenting the patient a safety feature?
Because it is a necessary cognitive filtering mechanism. Dr. Sahali's text even includes a vital warning about this. It explicitly states that this framework doesn't replace clinical supervision, institutional policies, or national guidelines.
Of course it doesn't replace them. It contextualizes them.
But the timeline is what matters here. In time-critical emergencies, you know, think acute coronary syndrome or severe sepsis, the disease label dictates the specific evidence-based pathway that prevents death.
Right, the algorithm.
Exactly. If you have a junior doctor blurring that hyper-focused algorithm with a broad philosophical assessment of capacity, you lose the rigorous algorithmic speed that modern medicine relies on. You need certainty to unlock those life-saving protocols.
Okay. Let's put your junior doctor in a real scenario then, just to see how this actually works. It's 2 a.m. in the ER. Under the traditional model, their brain just goes, cough plus fever equals pneumonia.
Yep.
Pneumonia means I prescribe these specific antibiotics and admit them. That's the reductive filter you're praising.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. That filter works. It gets the antibiotic into the bloodstream an hour faster.
But going back to our opening hook, what if it's patient B, the pneumonia patient who is profoundly delirious and hypotensive? the disease label is identical. The capacity failures, the failure of oxygenation, the failure of brain regulation, those are what actually dictate the true severity.
Well, obviously, severity matters.
Let me just give you an analogy. A disease label is just the name of the storm. The capacity failure is the actual damage to the house. You can't fix a house just by knowing a Category 4 hurricane hit it. You need to know if the roof is gone or if the foundation is flooded.
Okay, that's a compelling argument, but have you considered where that analogy completely breaks down in an emergency setting?
Where does it break down?
The damage to the house matters, obviously, but trying to treat the capacity failure without rapidly securing the exact disease label is deeply dangerous.
How so?
Well, if a patient comes in hypoxic, struggling for air, their oxygenation capacity has failed, right?
Right.
If you just treat that capacity, you throw oxygen on them, maybe give them some bronchodilators to open the airways, without differentiating the underlying storm, they could die right in front of you.
But the model doesn't say to just do that.
Is it a pulmonary embolism, a collapsed lung, severe pneumonia? The text has a danger-first protocol, which actually relies heavily on recognizing time-critical medical diagnosis.
It does. It definitely does.
Right. Recognizing an aortic dissection tearing through a blood vessel or an extreme potassium spike causing an arrhythmia. That requires rapid, reductive biomedical diagnostic thinking, not generalized capacity mapping.
Hold on, though. You're assuming the life coherent loop ignores the disease label entirely. It doesn't. It situates it. The actual sequence Sahali proposes is danger, syndrome, and then capacity failure.
Okay.
You identify the syndrome first, high-risk chest pain with sweating and nausea, for example. You are immediately capturing the danger of that aortic dissection or heart attack. But by simultaneously mapping the capacity failure, you prevent what psychologists call premature closure.
Meaning you don't just stop at the first easy answer.
Exactly. You realize the coronary circulation is threatened, yes, but their agency and comfort are also failing because they are terrified and in absolute agony. This forces the clinician to treat the pain, communicate clearly, and protect the patient's dignity, all while the algorithmic diagnostic pathway runs in the background.
The algorithm is still primary, though.
The label isolates the pathology, sure, but the capacity failure connects that pathology to the person's ability to actually survive it.
Look, you have to admit that putting agency on the same vital signs dashboard as a dropping oxygen level is just our recipe for ER paralysis.
It's really not.
When you have a patient crashing with septic shock, their defense mechanisms, their circulation, their regulatory capacities, they are literally all failing at once. The intervention that saves their life isn't a broad restoration of agency. It's source control.
Of course.
It's shoving intravenous fluids into their veins and blasting them with broad-spectrum antibiotics targeted at a specific biological organism.
I mean, nobody is arguing against antibiotics for sepsis.
But when we teach that junior doctor at 2 a.m., giving them way too many abstract variables to track under immense pressure diffuses the clinical urgency. The cognitive anchor has to be the disease.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how the text handles this. It provides the perfect answer. It explicitly defines danger first as the safety floor. Danger means addressing exactly what you just said. What could kill, disable, or destabilize the patient in the next 5 minutes?
Right. Stabilize them first.
But, and this is the crux of the whole thing, if you stop at the disease label, once that immediate physiological danger is temporarily stabilized, the patient is still in massive danger.
Okay, how do you mean? If they are stabilized, hasn't the model done its job?
Not if the treatment plan is impossible for the patient to actually execute, which, you know, organically moves us from stabilizing the immediate danger to understanding the context around it. This is the next step in Sahali's loop, what he calls coupling conditions.
Ah, right. This is where the model asks the clinician to essentially map out the patient's entire social, environmental, and structural context.
Yes. The text argues that chronic illnesses persist and acute exacerbations happen specifically because clinicians ignore these coupling conditions. Think of a diabetic patient coming into the clinic with persistently high blood sugar.
Okay.
The reductive biomedical model looks at the numbers and says, biological resistance, increase the insulin dose.
which is a perfectly logical, scientifically sound response to hyperglycemia.
Scientifically sound in a vacuum, sure, but the life coherent model forces the doctor to ask what that glucose regulation is coupled to in the real world.
Meaning their lifestyle.
Exactly. Is the patient working unpredictable night shifts that ruin their meal timing? Are they terrified of taking too much insulin because they live alone and fear a hypoglycemic coma? Can they even afford the continuous glucose monitors? If you just write a higher prescription and send them out the door, you haven't practiced good medicine.
I agree it's not comprehensive care. But look at the sheer burden this places on a physician. Formalizing social, environmental, and psychological factors into the primary cognitive loop risks completely overwhelming clinicians. We are talking about doctors who are already stretched to the breaking point.
But if we don't map it, the intervention fails anyway.
Think about that on-call shift again. The text explicitly outlines how to prioritize on-call duties. Immediate danger, deteriorating patients, critical results, and time-critical treatments. Forcing a doctor who is juggling four crashing patients to simultaneously map out a patient's transport issues, health literacy, and financial status is a massive distraction from the immediate biological stabilization required.
Its structural coupling feels like a luxury of the outpatient clinic, or maybe a multidisciplinary team meeting with social workers. It simply cannot be the primary engine of acute internal medicine.
It is not a luxury. Those coupling conditions, the real-world scaffolding holding the patient's life together, those are hard clinical data. This is where the text introduces the concept of a wise perturbation.
Right, the intervention.
Basically, any medical intervention is a perturbation, a disruption to the patient's current system. And the core insight here, the real breakthrough, is that a medical treatment a patient cannot live becomes an unsafe plan.
Let's dig into what that actually means on the ground, though.
Okay. If you prescribe a highly complex insulin sliding scale to a frail older patient with failing vision and irregular access to meals, you haven't delivered good biomedical care. You have literally just prescribed a future emergency room visit.
Well,
the biological cure is literally the poison because it doesn't match the organism's structural reality. Every treatment changes physiology, risk, and future possibilities.
I don't disagree that context matters eventually, but again, it's the timeline of reasoning. When a patient is admitted with an acute exacerbation of COPD, fighting for breath, their comorbid conditions, their 40-year smoking history, their damp apartment, their inability to coordinate an inhaler.
Those are huge factors.
They are, but they are entirely secondary to the immediate biological imperative of reversing the bronchospasm and correcting their carbon dioxide levels.
But the traditional model inherently filters that context out so thoroughly that it often never gets addressed at all.
Because under cognitive load, clinicians need to filter out the noise. The traditional model says, focus on the gas exchange first, fix the biology. The danger of the life coherent model is that it flattens the hierarchy of clinical information. It runs the risk of paralyzing the doctor by making them feel responsible for the damp apartment when they should be hyper-focused on the bronchodilator.
But fixing the biology isn't an illusion if you just discharge them back into the exact same structural trap that triggered the exacerbation in the first place,
yeah.
Which, you know, begs the question of what happens when they are ready to leave. How do we actually define and measure success in medicine?
The endpoint.
Exactly. The final step in Dr. Saley's loop is the repair trajectory. In our traditional system, we are taught to look for improving lab numbers, a dropping white blood cell count, a normalizing kidney function panel, a fever that breaks.
Because those were objective indicators that the pathology is resolving.
True, but improving numbers do not equal healing. The text provides a really chilling example. Picture an 89-year-old patient admitted for pneumonia. After 5 days, her fever is gone, she is off supplemental oxygen, her inflammatory markers have plummeted back to normal. The Biomedica model looks at the chart and declares victory. She is medically fit for discharge.
Biologically, the infection is cured.
But functionally, she remains deeply delirious. She is profoundly weak from spending 5 days in a hospital bed. She cannot walk to the bathroom safely. Discharging her based strictly on her normalized lab numbers is an incredibly unsafe transfer of risk. Redefining success as a repair trajectory means tracking whether the patient is actually becoming safer, stronger, and more able to live in their environment, not just whether we successfully suppress their pathology with chemicals.
Okay, I will concede that discharging the 89-year-old just because her lab numbers look good is a systemic failure. We've all seen the revolving door of hospital readmissions caused by exactly that.
Right.
But we must be incredibly careful about swinging the pendulum too far the other way. Subjective functional assessments must never eclipse objective biomedical markers. Let's look at the quiet dangers the text itself warns us about.
The silent physiological threats.
Yes. Take a patient with acute kidney injury. They might feel absolutely fine. Their functional capacity might seem totally intact. They are walking the halls, chatting with nurses, eating their meals. But if you run their labs and their potassium is 6.4, that is severe hyperkalemia. They are in imminent danger of a lethal cardiac arrhythmia. Their heart could stop at any second.
And the life coherent model would catch that?
Would it? If we redefine repair to heavily weigh subjective functional states, or agency, or palliative comfort, we might inadvertently train clinicians to take their eyes off the strict, numerical tracking of objective biological harms. The numbers matter, because biology doesn't care how the patient feels. It operates on cold, objective thresholds.
I completely agree that biology operates on thresholds, but the life coherent model doesn't ignore the potassium of 6.4. In fact, it specifically categorizes that as a failure of clearance capacity and electrical stability. That is recognized as a profound danger. The argument here isn't to replace numbers with subjective feelings.
Then what is the shift?
The shift is that the numbers must be interpreted through the lens of life capacity. Why does a potassium of 6.4 matter? Not because it's a red number on a screen, but because it fundamentally threatens the regulation and coordination of the cardiac pump. The loop demands that we ask, how will healing actually be recognized for this specific patient?
Which introduces massive subjective interpretation.
It introduces human reality. For the hyperkalemic patient, yes, repair means the potassium drops to a safer level, the ECG stabilizes, and urine output improves. But for the delirious pneumonia patient, repair means clearer attention, restoration of a normal sleep-wake rhythm, and their family recognizing they are back to their baseline. The traditional model measures what is easy to measure, the blood test. The life coherent model demands we do the hard work of measuring what actually matters to the organism's survival and dignity.
The reason the traditional model relies on what you call easy to measure metrics is because they are standardized, reproducible, and universal. A troponin level measuring heart damage is a troponin level, whether you are in New York or Nairobi. It completely removes the bias of the observer.
But it doesn't capture the whole picture.
When you start defining repair as agency, dignity, or meaningful participation in society, you are injecting a massive amount of subjective philosophy into medical science. The text asks if the patient can return to meaningful life roles. That is a beautiful, noble, philosophical goal, but is it a strictly medical one?
I'd argue it has to be.
Here is my fear. If a clinician's primary anchor becomes preserving dignity and participation, they might undertreat a highly reversible condition simply because the treatment is burdensome in the short term. The rigorous adherence to biomedical guidelines ensures that every single patient, regardless of a doctor's subjective reading of their capacity, gets the absolute standard of care to preserve their biology.
But treating the standard of care as a purely biological exercise frequently violates the very oath to do no harm. Let's talk about polypharmacy in frail patients, because this is where the biomedical model actively damages people.
Okay, let's go there.
You have a frail older patient. They have three distinct labels: diabetes, hypertension, and heart failure. If you rigidly adhere to the isolated biomedical guidelines for all three of those diseases, you end up prescribing a dozen different medications.
Following the evidence base for each pathology.
Observe their frailty, the combination of an ACE inhibitor for the heart, a diuretic to clear fluids, and maybe an over-the-counter NSAID for their joint pain, completely crashes their kidneys. You cause acute kidney injury. Meanwhile, the aggressive insulin targets cause severe hypoglycemia because they aren't eating regular meals.
Polypharmacy is definitely a huge risk.
It's more than a risk. By treating the isolated diseases perfectly according to the textbook guidelines, you have profoundly harmed the whole living person. That is why the Life Coherent Loop forces you to ask about a WISE perturbation. Is this intervention proportionate to what their system can handle? Strict biomedical tracking without capacity mapping is precisely what leads to iatrogenic, doctor-caused harm in complex patients.
I don't dispute the danger of polypharmacy, but the solution isn't to abandon the disease-centric model. The solution is actually to apply biomedical pharmacology more rigorously. Understanding complex drug-drug interactions and renal clearance requires deep mechanistic biological knowledge. You have to know the half-life of the drug, the glomerular filtration rate of the kidneys, the specific receptor targets. That is not holistic capacity mapping. That is hard, unyielding science.
But science applied without context is blind.
Listen, if you rely too heavily on the concept of WISE perturbation and proportionate care, you invite therapeutic nihilism. A doctor might look at a frail, older patient with a severe infection and decide that aggressive treatment is disproportionate. They might prematurely shift to palliative comfort care, assuming the patient's capacity is permanently gone, when a rigorous 3-day course of IV fluids and antibiotics could have easily returned them to their baseline. The objective disease label protects the patient against that kind of bias. It says, this is the disease, treat it.
And the text actually anticipates that exact bias. Dr. Sali explicitly defines frailty not as an excuse to undertreat, but as a severe reduction in physiological reserve across multiple capacities, meaning the stressor looks small, but the biological response is huge.
Right, they crash faster.
Exactly. The Life Coherent approach demands we understand their baseline function before the crash. If you don't map their capacities, you don't even know what baseline you are trying to restore. The traditional model processes patients on a conveyor belt. It admits them, runs the algorithm, normalizes the lab numbers, and discharges them.
It cures them.
Sometimes. But the Life Coherent Loop recognizes that every perturbation, an admission, a biopsy, a new medication, fundamentally changes the living system. If a patient is admitted for a minor urinary tract infection and we cure that infection with antibiotics, but in the process we cause hospital-acquired delirium through sleep disruption, sensory deprivation, and unnecessary sedatives, we have failed. We fixed the biology of the bacteria, but we broke the patient's brain regulation.
Hospital-acquired delirium is a massive failure of care. I completely agree. But again, the mechanism to prevent it is biological and protocol-driven. You check their oxygen, you check their blood glucose, you treat their pain, you relieve urinary retention, you remove anticholinergic drugs that mess with their neurotransmitters. Those are highly specific, targeted interventions against distinct physiological disruptions.
Yes, but...
Dr. Saheli's framework is deeply compelling. The 6 steps, danger, syndrome, capacity failure, coupling conditions, WISE perturbation, repair trajectory, they provide a genuinely beautiful narrative arc for how we should care for human beings. But in the trenches of internal medicine, when multiple patients are deteriorating simultaneously and alarms are blaring, the clinician desperately needs the sharp, cutting edge of the diagnostic label to triage and treat effectively.
Well, as we wrap this up, my position stands that internal medicine simply has to evolve past biological reductionism. We are reaching the limits of what that model can do. The traditional disease framework gives us a comforting illusion of control, but patients are not isolated variables in a petri dish.
True.
The Life Coherent Loop isn't throwing away medical knowledge or physiological protocols. It's providing the necessary scaffolding to organize that knowledge around a living, breathing patient. By moving from an abstract disease label to the concrete reality of capacity failure and real-world coupling conditions, we protect patients from the harms of fragmented, hyper-specialized care. We finally recognize that symptoms, diseases, and treatments all collide inside a fragile, interconnected living system.
And my takeaway is that while whole-person care is an essential ideal, the objective disease label simply has to remain the physician's primary cognitive anchor. The scientific precision of the biomedical model, that exact reductionism, is what has driven the incredible advancements in survival rates over the last century.
Mm-hmm.
Rigorous adherence to guidelines, a relentless focus on objective physiological data, and the fast algorithmic pursuit of the diagnosis are what actually keep patients safe in high-stakes environments. We must consider the patient's context, absolutely,
But allowing abstract concepts of capacity to overshadow the strict biological diagnosis invites a really dangerous ambiguity into life or death decisions.
Well, I think we've hit a really critical point of convergence today, even with our different approaches. We both absolutely agree that treating isolated lab numbers in a vacuum without looking at the whole clinical context is bad medicine.
100%. And we also completely agree that discharging a patient prematurely just because their blood test normalized without making sure they can actually function safely at home is an unacceptable failure of care.
Exactly. There is this inherent, unresolvable tension in medicine. We are constantly caught between the clean, mathematical precision of scientific pathology and the deeply messy complexity of human life. We are essentially trying to map a highly dynamic, interconnected territory using two-dimensional blueprints.
It's a huge challenge.
Dr. Sahili's text offers a really profound challenge to how we train clinicians to think. It urges us to look beyond the blueprint and see the structure as it actually stands in the real world. The plumbing is wrapped around the wiring. The foundation affects the roof. And fixing the house requires way more than just knowing the name of the storm that hit it. Thank you for joining us on this exploration, and we leave it to you to decide how the practice of medicine should best navigate this complexity.